RCR with Paul Brennan.
In the last week of February, we talked with Shane Jones about special economic zones. And he seemed quite enthusiastic about the idea. It's not a new concept. It's been tried in other places around the world over the years. And he was really referring to a special economic zone regarding our energy needs. And we thought we'd get Michael Riedel, our favorite economist, and you know the backstory of Michael by now, to come on and comment. He's written a few pieces about this. He's been opining on it, special economic zones. Michael, welcome back to RCR. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Paul.
Okay, Shane Jones was quite enthusiastic. He was, I won't say he was doing a hard sell, but he had some energy behind his, you know, describing the idea to us. Is it something to get excited about?
I mean, Shane Jones gets excited about lots of things, and that's a good thing in many respects. Special economic zones, I think, are one of those things to be quite sceptical of. As you say, they've been used in plenty of countries overseas. The record is pretty mixed. Most commonly, they've been used in places. The best known example probably is in China, where, you know, Deng Xiaoping got to the stage of sort of being willing to begin to open up the Chinese economy, had to deal with a lot of scepticism in the Communist Party and the rest of the establishment. So I said, well, let's try some things down there in Shenzhen, and it certainly worked, and a lot of that sort of more liberalization thing has been broadened out into the wider Chinese economy over time. The problem for an economy like ours is we're not starting from that point. You know, we're starting from an open political system. And, you know, if there are good things that we can do to enable business and to enhance economic growth, as the government says it cares about, let's do them countrywide, not do them in special areas where, you know, one politician happens to champion them, one councillor, one set of lobbyists.
So we should be a countrywide special economic zone if we're thinking like that. I mean, we're certainly the right size to be, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just over 5 million people. I've heard the minister mention company tax, for example. You know, we should have lower taxes on business, but we should have them across the entire economy. That's one of the best ways to attract more foreign investment, which has got to be a significant part of improving our growth prospects. Same goes for the, you know, RMA type planning restrictions. The government's got legislation coming on that. You want to make things easy to build, easy to develop across the entire country.
Are we moving too slow?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. In some respects, government's hamstrung by, you know, take those two things. Company tax, it's very difficult to do anything about it now because they're starting from a position of very big deficits. Those deficits were partly inherited from the previous government, but they were actually reinforced last year by the fact that this government chose, instead of reducing the deficit, to spend the money on tax cuts for households. Most economists would agree that if what you're concerned about is longer-term economic growth, the most distortionary taxes are company taxes, taxes on business, because investors just don't have to be here. They can go on and operate somewhere else. You or I live here. We've got strong ties to the place. Most of us aren't going anywhere in the short term. Yeah. The RMA is one of those things that, you know, getting that legislation right, it just inevitably takes time. You know, it's complex legislation. You've got to go through a consultation select committee process. But I mean, my own view is that over the first 15 months or so of this government, there hasn't been a lot of urgency in a number of areas, and we are paying a price for that.
People feel, or many people feel, there should be urgency, and you know, time is kind of against us if we sort of tread water for too long. Yet the politicians, the people who should be leading here, don't get that or are too timid to move ahead.
Yeah, I mean, my own sense is that if you look back to the election campaign, neither Chris Luxon nor Nicola Willis had any particularly strong narrative or model or way of understanding why it is that New Zealand had been performing so badly over a long period of time. So they didn't come to the election saying, here's our agenda of big things that are going to make a big difference. They found that we're in a sort of nasty recession over the last year as a result of the Reserve Bank's actions to get inflation down. And that seems to have sort of sparked this new focus on growth this year. But they don't have, it seems, compelling ideas. They've often got quite small things, you know, an emphasis on reading and writing in schools. That's helpful, but it will start to pay dividends in 15 years' time when those young people move into the workforce. We need to see those changes, but we need to see much bigger changes in the near term. It's not always obvious that our bureaucrats have a lot of good ideas either. You look at the advice that comes to the government from the Treasury, for example, and again, it tends to focus on the small stuff, even though we've got a really big problem. We're so far now behind a whole bunch of other countries, not just Australia, but the US and the leading European countries as well.
I feel we specialize in small stuff. That's another chat. Getting back to what you mentioned about company tax, business tax, we are witnessing in the United States what looks like the uncovering of huge wastage. And now we probably run a bit differently, but a lot of us are thinking there's probably similar wastage here, or maybe we should be looking to find out. Isn't it time to do that? Because when you hear of $4 million to do whale sounds in the Kauri forests, you wonder, how many X's is that sort of expenditure going on? And that would create, if we could save there, the opportunity to rejig the company tax, for example.
I think there is room for improvement in that area. Some of those egregious examples, the one you mentioned, some of the grants to these extraordinary political research projects. One I often mention, the Reserve Bank has 2.5 times as many staff as it had 6 or 7 years ago and no different functions. That said, I think most economists would agree that if you really are serious about cutting government spending, you've got to decide that the government's not going to do this, that, or the other thing. You've got to cut programs. The amount that's spent on public service salaries or even grants to scientists is second order, third order significance compared to things like film subsidies or KiwiSaver grants or universal pensions at 65, those sorts of things. And those are politically difficult calls to make, but we've got to be willing to make them if we're willing to, if we're wanting to change quickly and give ourselves room to make those more growth-oriented choices.
Back to the special economic zones, he's singled out in his messaging, fuel resilience, energy resilience. Obviously, people are conscious that the refinery is no longer operating or doesn't even exist. There's a site there, Deepwater Port. LNG importing has been talked about. We don't have the infrastructure to deal with that. It kind of sounds like he knows, the gap. For shooting the gap might be kind of closing if we go at the regular speed, and is putting that example up because he can actually, if he really has to, show that this is something, this is an item, let's say, or an area that we can't linger around, we can't go slow, because at any moment the world could turn and we got no diesel,
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some real issues there. It's quite strange that our strategic fuel reserves basically now consist of contracts to buy from overseas. If we ever have a sort of World War III and the Chinese cut off the shipping lanes, we've got no ability to necessarily ship fuel here. Of course, the refinery itself didn't solve that problem because mostly we were refining imported
No, but
crude.
we had the ability to drill and catch up there if we were so desperate, right?
Yeah, but even then, it probably takes several years to sort of get
Right.
the production and that sort of thing. So, I mean, yes, there are challenges there. They've always been there because the strategic environment is no longer as benign as it was. I think that one of the things you've got to be cautious about with Shane Jones going on in Northland is to realise Northland's where he comes from.
I
It's where
know.
his electoral interests are. If he were championing, Gisborne or Timaru or something of the sort, you might look at it with a slightly different lens. And so one of my concerns here has been that, I'm sure he's a true believer in this stuff, but what we saw with the fast track legislation last year was a whole bunch of concerns around, well, how do you get on the fast track list? Have there been advantages to people who donated to particular political parties? Are there rewards to who's got the best lobbyist rather than the best economic case? And I think there's a lot of those sorts of concerns that apply, there in Northland, as well.
Yeah, to have a level of transparency to be confident that's not happening, that's next level too, because everything would have to be completely open then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and by and large, you do want it to be so. But again, to the extent that you're liberalising on an economy-wide basis, those concerns tend to drop away. They can still be there to some extent, but you're not sort of lobbying this company versus that company, this region versus that region. But you're looking more broadly.
Potential Pandora's box there, maybe.
Yeah, indeed. And this whole question of corruption in New Zealand, right? I mean, we tend to sort of score reasonably well on those Transparency International perceptions indexes, but we're no longer as good as we were. And perceptions tend to lag reality. We do have to sort of stomp on pretty quickly any suggestions of developing corruption or doubts in that direction.
It's always been done quietly here.
Indeed. And
If you were to think of areas in the country, except obviously the area we've talked about already, that would suit a special economic zone based on, I don't know, impoverishment through lack of engagement of the economy or whatever, where would you think? Would provincial towns or areas that are kind
well, I
of
mean, I think
not
it's
been doing
one of
so
the
well be
problems.
candidates?
Yeah, it's one of the problems with the model, right? It's that why are regions that are relatively poor, poor? Often it's because the economic opportunities are no longer there. And so what special economic zones do, special favours to particular regions, like picking winners for particular companies, is risking throwing good money after bad. Across the Western world these days, and in fact, East Asia as well, a lot of additional added value actually arises in cities, in big cities. And so some people would argue that if you're going to have a special economic zone, you should think about making it Auckland. They run the line,
How would
it's
that go
one.
down?
Yeah, well, precisely. But there's a certain logic to it. Average incomes in Auckland are a bit higher than those in the rest of the country. It's certainly not a New York or a San Francisco or a London or anything of the sort like that. But you can look at Christchurch, for example. A reasonably significant population centre, good international connections, a lot of easy access to land, good educated population. Maybe there'd be some potential there. But you'd have to wonder, though, if you're looking at places like Northland and Gisborne, whether it mightn't be that the better answer is for more of those people to move towards cities. I mean, that's been the experience across Western countries ever since the Industrial Revolution. There are fewer people who live in Wyoming or Montana now than did 120 years ago. And there are good fundamental economic reasons for that. It's probably true, say, of the west coast of New Zealand as well.
What about the role of free trade agreements? They would that th there would be a sort of dovetailing there potentially with a special economic zone set aside for a purpose, wouldn't there? You could sort of put the two together, and does it align anything that we need to align to get these deals or to get people interested in being in business with us?
I'm not sure that the free trade agreements are particularly the issue. I mean, our foreign investment restrictions are probably more relevant there. But,
Right.
to the extent that we moved in the direction of a radical liberalisation of foreign investment and said, look, the only reason we're going to restrict investment is on national security grounds, incredible strong national security
Well,
grounds.
why don't we do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ACT Party policy. I think they run into resistance from Shane Jones's own party. I mean, New Zealand First has been the ones who've been reluctant to see foreign investment laws radically liberalised. And it's not clear to me what they're particularly worried about. Other than national security, you can't take a company with you. You can't take the land with you. It's here. We regulate it. We control it. But we should be welcoming that investment because it's one of the best ways to lift wages of New Zealanders.
Do you see the work being done to, I mean, the Prime Minister's been in Vietnam, Winston's been out and about as well around the place, pushing hard there?
Well, I mean, there's two things. The free trade agreements, we've signed quite a lot of them over the last 25 years. Over that period, unfortunately, our exports as a share of GDP have been shrinking, not increasing. Now, that doesn't mean those agreements have been harmful, but it just says that there are bigger forces at work. And the helpful difference that they may make is probably fairly small. On the foreign investment side, there have been some useful moves. The government announced some steps towards liberalisation a couple of weeks ago. We haven't seen the legislation yet, so we don't know quite whether the substance is going to stack up with the rhetoric. So it's a bit like a lot of things with this government. They're sort of moving in the right direction, but often very slowly. And that's the positive thing of Shane Jones. If Shane Jones brings energy to these things, drive, he wants something different. It's just a question of the merits of his specifics.
I'm probably asking you to commentate on political matters. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But in terms of our Prime Minister, he has a history in business. People are aware of, Unilever, Air New Zealand, and expected a sharp business mind to be brought to bear in the job. Have we been seeing that?
I think one of the things that people miss is that a company is not a country, that the skills that you need to make an individual company work really effectively, including multinationals like Unilever, where the Prime Minister worked, are quite different from the policy-making challenges in a country. And I mean, he doesn't have any particular background in those areas, nor do many politicians, and it's why it's really important that we have top-notch economic advice coming through from our think tanks, our universities, our government departments like the Treasury. And I don't think the government and the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance are being terribly well served in that area at the moment.
On that point, we spoke to Rob McCulloch a week or so ago, and he was pretty grumpy about the same old people always being brought back. He cited some names off the top of my head. I could try and remember them. But I think he had a point
Yeah, I
that there's
mean,
no new view, there's no contrary, a view in the room, it seems. It's just the same old people trotted out with the same old thing they did 30 years ago. That was the impression I got from what he's
yeah,
saying.
and I mean, I don't agree with everything Rob says, but I think on that one he's right. And the Treasury is a good example, right? The last year, the Minister of Finance said what she wanted was a new Secretary of the Treasury who brought fresh, innovative ideas, was going to explore and be radical and all that sort of thing. When the decision was finally made, she brought back somebody who'd been a Deputy Secretary of the Treasury 17 years ago, was renowned as a safe pair of hands, good at managing upwards, but was never seen as a bold, innovative, or fresh thinker. And it's too often the story around these government department appointments that have been made in recent years. It's probably true of government boards and those sorts of things, as Rob said as well.
Well, he did say that there was, in his view, one of the most talented economists in the world living here, and no one's ever asked him for a view.
Yeah, I think he's a bit wrong on that one. I mean, he's definitely right about Peter Phillips, who's a very highly regarded econometrician, does economic modelling and all those sorts of things. He's not strongly a policy guy. He's a very able economist. I think he's quite old now as well. You probably wouldn't be wanting to put him in a policy making role. But we don't have that general enthusiasm, the willingness to say we've got into a really deep hole here over many years. How do we find our way out of it? Small changes won't produce big differences, and so on.
Okay, just to sum up, I mean, we've talked about interest rates before, you and I, on many occasions. Where are we on inflation, do you think? People seem to be getting the impression that interest rates are coming down. We'll start buying houses again. I don't know if that's going to be what happens. And also, we have been in a recession for as long as it takes to officially be in one. How do you see this year emerging? What's your crystal ball telling you?
I mean, I think we are going to be seeing a pretty sluggish recovery, but emphasis on the recovery, so long as the world economy doesn't go crazy. I mean, we've seen overnight, for example, Trump reconfirming these tariffs on Canada and Mexico. That's enormously destructive. It's going to add a huge amount of uncertainty in the world economy. And so things could go wrong offshore. If they don't, we will see things picking up here. We'll see interest rates falling further. I think inflation is reasonably likely to fall below 2%. And so I still think the Reserve Bank will have to cut the OCR to probably 2.5, two and three quarters before things really level out. And that's probably by, August, September this year.
Again, I hate to always compare things to Trump, but we're seeing it right in front of us. He looks like someone who can make a deal, and play hard ball. And depending on what side of the fence you're on, you either believe that or you don't. But it just reminds us that maybe, we need to find a bit of mojo here and start really, putting the pedal to the metal, as they say, and really lift our game. It just feels like it's too sluggish.
I mean, I agree with that totally. I mean, it's 40 years this week since we floated our exchange rate in the middle of the Roger Douglas reforms. Roger Douglas, like him or not, was somebody who brought energy, a drive, a questioning desire to produce a better New Zealand and a better New Zealand for all New Zealanders. There's been a strong sense, I think Matthew Hooton makes this point in his columns, that too many of our politicians at the moment seem to be content to win office and hold office. They're not too concerned about transforming things for the better for our kids and grandkids. You lose sight of the fact, or they do too readily, that we're now no longer more than about 60% as wealthy as those leading European countries. We used to be richer than them all. We could be again, but it's not going to happen by magic. We've got to do the hard work. the innovative policy ideas, the hard thinking, and be willing to break a few things too, probably.
Remember when we had that economic summit?
Yeah, indeed.
Thing of Douglas.
I mean, to be fair, the economic summit was mostly political theatre.
I know, but it focused minds.
It did. And now the Prime Minister will say he's got his International Investment Summit next week. And let's see what comes
No,
of
but they had
that.
people in Parliament live on TV
Yeah, no, I
standing up
remember.
and saying their piece.
I remember it, and then most of it got ignored.
Yeah, I know.
I
That's
mean,
it.
I'm reasonably cynical about summits. I think
Yeah.
they have a place in a political marketing sphere. What you need is able people with ideas, and then politicians who are skilled at marketing and selling those strategies and taking people with them, convincing them that big change is actually something that's in their own long-term best interests. David Lange, at his peak, was very good at doing that.
He
He wasn't
was.
the economist, he was in partnership with Douglas. But
Come
we
with
don't
me, he used to say. Come with me.
know. Indeed,
And
indeed.
even loved Mr. Longy, or was that Muldoon loving Mr. Longy?
Yeah,
I can't
Mr.
remember.
Muldoon, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Great catching up with you. We'll keep an eye on what or how far special economic zones go as a concept. And there'll be plenty to talk about this year into 2025. Thank you, Michael Riddell, for coming back on RCR.
Good. Pleasure, Paul.